Yeah, here for the entire week. And Frederico is also giving a second seminar on Thursday. But today, the seminar is on cosmology and more specifically on the Diletantes from Darwin.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for the invitation. And what I'm going to talk about is an idea through which we may have a phenomenologically acceptable theory of gravity from string theory. Just to introduce the main idea, let's consider the string action at three level, low energy, already compactified to four dimension. And as you see, there is a definite prediction of string theory in the presence of a scalar field, the dilaton, which tells you the value of the couplings. So in principle, of course, this is a very welcome occurrence that all the parameters of the theory is not to be put in by hands, but are in a way determined in a dynamical way. On the other hand, the fact that the couplings are dynamical generally lead to unacceptable variations of the constants of the couplings itself. So, if you recognize, if you see e to the minus phi plays the role of 1 over alpha Bucle GUT, GUT. So, in principle, the couplings are not constant because of the dilaton in this field. And if you wanted to evaluate the 0.1 over 25, somewhere between 0.1 and 0.01, where the couplings seem to unify at M GUT, at the GUT scale, you should require that the dilaton is stacked at a value which is about minus 3 here. On the other hand, very related to this is that because of this dynamical nature of the coupling, both the effective Planck mass and the gauge couplings, because of the dynamical nature, there are generally from this action you would expect unacceptable violation of the equivalence principle. So the conventional solution, the conventional wisdom about this problem is to suppose that the dilaton acquires a mass from some non perturbative mechanism. So it has some potential of some non perturbative origin, which at the same time fixes its value at a sensible value of alpha GUT. And since now the dilaton has a mass, it's not going to propagate. It's not going to be a light field anymore. It's going to propagate over distances of the inverse of the mass, and then the equivalence principle should be restored at distances longer than the inverse mass that it requires. What I'm going to talk about is a different proposal from a different solution, and the claim is that the effective correction to the string action should render physically acceptable the region where the dilaton is running to infinity. So the dilaton may not be fixed, it may be running, still you would have an acceptable gravity and acceptable and no significant variations of the coupling constants. So this is why. So it's called.
Wasn't it shown that when you have a runaway potential, the dilaton, that this is not acceptable meaning you have unacceptable variations of it.
Well, this is true. This is true if you. So this is true if you believe this action, this frame.
This is the low energy effective action. So
yes. What I'm saying is that What I'm saying is that this is very a tree level. We are not considering the quantum corrections of all the other fields moduli of the. What I'm claiming is that perhaps these quantum corrections renders a runaway dilaton in this region, so in the region where the dilaton has a big value, they're acceptable and sensible physically.
So what it also means is that the gravitational constant is very running, right? With values of 5.
Well, yeah, again.
What is acceptable?
Again, this is how the tree level action looks like. The quantum correction changes the dependence of the effective Newton constant from the dilaton. So the effective Newton constant is, so let's say the effective mass Planck mass squared is not any longer e to the minus phi, but a function of phi, a much better behavior. Okay, I'm not going to show it in a. So yeah, so the plan of the seminar is the following. Again, strong coupling. By strong coupling, I mean strong three-level coupling. So first of all, I will talk about the idea and the theoretical motivations of this idea. Now we talk about the gravitational phenomenology of this model. Interestingly enough, this model predicts observable, well, very violations of the equivalence principle, which should be observed in the next to come experiments. Then I will talk about possibility of using this runaway dilaton as spin essence, and I will then draw some conclusions. So let's start by reviewing very briefly the idea of effective actions. You have the theory, say your bona fide fundamental theory at the cutoff, and what you're doing is say, okay, in order to describe low energy physics, I may integrate over all the high energy modes, which may be massive fields, or maybe the modes itself of the fields, which are just very energetic. And what you end up is an action, an effective theory. As a typical example is the one of the electroweak interactions. If you integrate out the massive W and Z boson, you obtain a four Fermi interaction of the Fermi type. And of course, generally, if you start with a renormalizable theory, you end up with a theory which is not a renormalizable, but you know, this is going to be effective and sensible only to energies given by some cutoff that you put. So, and the cutoff is given by the modes over which you have integrated this thing. So another example which I find very interesting is the old idea of induced gravity. So basically, if you start at the fundamental level, say with a theory which not contains gravity from the beginning, so a theory of the metal fields, and that of course contains the metric in the covariant derivatives and so on. So if you start with a generic curved space-time, you formulate the quantum field theory on it, but you don't suppose any dynamical interaction for the metric field. You end up, if you integrate over the massive modes, you end up having, in fact, Well, in general, you will have a cosmological constant, and this is another way to see the cosmological constant problem. But then you will have also a Ricci term, you know, of course, weighted, every term is weighted by powers of the cutoff, and plus higher derivative terms in germanium. So yes, you don't put gravity at the fundamental level, but you in a sense get it at an effect. So in order to justify the assumptions that I'm going to do in the following, I briefly reviewed this three model considered by Veneziano in 2001, and he just considered a field theory which contains gravity, gauge fields of high rank, a large number of fermions, and a large number of scalars. And I say, okay, this is a theory with some cutoff lambda. So the idea is let's integrate completely out the scalars and the fermions first, and a step which is much less trivial, let's integrate over gravity and gauge loops. At least let's do one loop calculation. So this step, in order to do this step, one has to hypothesize to work in the large n limit, where n is generically the number of the rank of the gauge fields, the number of fermions, and the number of scalars, and you also have to make an hypothesis on the relative numbers of scalar and fermions with respect to the number of the rank of the gauge field. But what you end up if all these hypotheses are satisfied is that the renormalization of the bare gravitational couplings is as follows. So this is the renormalized effective coupling. So you get the old coupling to the minus 2 plus, of course, powers of the cutoff weighted by order n, where n is generically this large number that you're considering. So the same is true for the gauge fields, and of course in d equal 4 you discover the logarithmic running of the couplings, of the gauge couplings. So if you believe this model, you may apply it to string theory, where in fact, let's say, the cutoff is the string mass. The bare inverse coupling, as we saw at the beginning, is e to the minus phi. So the exponential of the theorem plays the role of the three-level coupling sense, and we just call the with this function of phi, bg for gravity, b phi for the kinetic field, the kinetic term of phi, and bf for the gauge fields. We call with this function the effective inverse coupling. So if you believe this, the claim of the previous transparency, we should end up with the following answers on this effective coupling. So you see that in a way which is a bit similar to the induced gravity idea, most of the coupling is given by loop effects, by radiative effects. These my dependence on phi is what is left from the original bare coupling. So we expect in this model that these couplings are dominated by this number, and plus corrections of order e to the minus 5, which means, so these are order n, so n in string theory is more or less 100, is some number of order 100, which is the typical rank of the gauge fields you're integrating over, and so you have a number of order 100 plus a number of order 1 times e to the minus 5. So this is the answer that you're using. So you see that.
I just wanted to ask, I mean, how do you define the ground state of this?
The ground state?
Yeah. So what do you call, for instance, a vacuum state?
Sorry, what do you call, for instance?
A vacuum state. Because, I mean, I'm worrying about linear coupling between the field theory sector and the gravitational sector, so your dispersion relation is kind of a weird cutoff. It's not only a cutoff in the phase space of your quantum fields, but it mixes also space-time coordinates with momentum coordinates, so
there
is no well-defined initial value problem somehow if you impose such a cutoff in curved space.
Well, there is a complete covariant way to calculate the effective done by the width and so on. You just
but the problem is your dispersion relation now is the dispersion for any quantum field you have here for any phi or whatsoever is a dispersion relation in curved space time.
Yeah.
And as such, it mixes momentum and space time coordinates. And if you impose a cutoff the way you did it,
yeah,
it's not, I mean, it's something one has to think about how to define them, because the vacuum state, I mean.
But even if one supposed that independent of string theory and so on, a cutoff at the Planck scale, you are expected to have some strange special relation, and in fact, this is what they're looking for in some experiments. They're trying to look at the Lorentz violations.
But that's why I'm asking how you define the ground state, because it depends on how arbitrary your result would be. Because if you define your ground state as the minimum of your time dependent Hamiltonian, which would be the proper definition of it, you could do time dependent Legendre transformation. Of course, in the Legendre transformation, usually do not alter your physical results, your observables. But since you define your vacuum state via time-dependent Hamiltonian, everything will depend on this definition. Actually, Veneziano showed that in the paper. It's called
but
the new physics hypersurface proposal. I mean,
I don't know what's my answer to it.
In fact, the field theory, I believe what's below land and not what's above it.
Yeah, exactly, yes.
So therefore, you can only work with this for energy less than land. Forget about what's above land.
No, but with this vacuum, any mode, if you go in Fourier space, any mode sees a different vacuum space because it crosses this cutoff at a different time. So we have no, I mean, it's very difficult to come up with a reasonable definition of a ground state for all modes. All modes see different.
Still, I don't see the difference. I mean, this is a problem. As you say, it should be a problem even in the ones.
It was just interesting. I mean, if you have some idea for that.
If I understand your proposal so far, your proposal is take general relativity coupled to some quantum fields and do perturbation theory with a fixed cutoff. Should be very well defined. And then run the normalization group. And you're interested in what happens. I mean, you wrote down first order perturbative corrections to the couplings with fixed cutoff. And now you want to go to, if I understand correctly, you want to go to strong values of the dimensionless constants, large values of the dimensionless constants. but
so the values of the three-level cup, yes.
Of the dimensionless cup.
Of the dimensionless three-level,
But just, I mean, this has nothing to do with string theory. You're just operating below the Planck scale, the string scale is just quantum field theory with the cutoff. And my understanding is you can only do that if there's some non-trivial fixed point of the normalization group that lets you define what you mean by the asymptotic limit. Am I wrong? I mean, otherwise, I mean, could you just write some perturbative formula which is good for small dimensionless couplings everywhere, and now you want to go to large dimensionless couplings?
Yeah. I think the solution of, so the answer to your question is into the details of the large n limit of Veneziano's paper. I mean,
I don't know anything about Veneziano's paper, but
yeah.
the normalization group in that large n limit has been studied by different people for many years, and there is evidence that there's a non-trivial fixed point to the normalization group to leading order to 1 over n. But it seems to me if you want to know what your constant ci, that's the constant ci can only, understanding correct, can only refer to how things would run to a non-trivial fixed point of the normalization group. Otherwise, your dimensionless couplings just run to infinity, and all the b's just go to infinity, and you don't have the theory.
What you mean, they go to infinity,
but it's
satisfying
phi or something? Well, I'm just reading phi as related to log g. Large phi is large log g.
Large g.
Yeah. I mean,
let's put on this. This final answers. So I mean, what I'm saying is just that the radical correction should overcome the original presence of the three-level.
Right. So if you write, say, the beta function for cap is zero, it starts off like -2 plus something of order n.
Log
of the cutoff. And g0 is or is not asymptotically free depending on the numbers of fermions and so forth. But even if you just worry about the Newton's constant and the cosmological, you might have a cosmological constant, but there's also a run of the cosmological constant.
So if you
look in the dimensionless with respect to the cutoff, means constant cosmological constant plane.
Yeah.
Okay. You're going to be running off.
Well, unless
there's a non-trivial fixed point you can run to.
Well, you're definitely right. The cosmological constant problem is there. And in fact, I should have, I mean, the very same quantum corrections that give you a correction of this type to the Newton constant should also give you a cosmological constant of the order of the cutoff. That's for sure. And we just hypothesize that for some mechanism, as usual, the cosmological constant is a zero.
Well, but it's not a question of mechanism. There's a reasonable amount of evidence that there is a non-trivial fixed point in the Newton's constant cosmological constant plane. And if the cosmological constant were not a variable, it wouldn't be there. So in fact, the cosmological constant is needed. The bare cosmological constant is needed so that the theory is well-defined in the limit you want to study. But anyway, I don't want to interrupt you, someone. I just want to know if you're making use of that. And
no.
It seems to me. Okay, well, if you're not making use of that, then your dimensionless constants are just running off to infinity.
Yeah.
So why is there any effect of field theory?
Why is there any effect?
Why do you get any? If your dimensionless constants just run off to infinity, then how are you going to, even with a fixed cutoff, how are you going to propose to do physics?
Well, here comes again. I mean, the first step here is trivial. When you integrate those cars and fairness, you don't even mention the coupling, right? Mm-hmm. Because there's just I consider three scalars and fairness. The delicate point is again this large L limit. So so I think that the loop calculations has been done in the large limit. So that we could also consider a large-ish three-level couplings in order to do the calculation.
Sure. Okay.
Anyway,
go ahead.
I think I just wanted to add, unfortunately, that I do believe that what you're doing is called the asymptotic-free renormalization group flow effective action program. There's a large literature in this. And they do exactly what you're doing there.
Asymptotic extent.
And there are fixed points. You can show there are fixed points that are non-renormalizable in a non-perturbative scheme of RT flow.
Uh-huh.
But why do you think this has to do with string theory?
Well,
which is really down an effective classical
method. Because you take the theory, the string theory at three level, and you see that the role of the bare coupling is played by e to the minus phi, and you got a cutoff which is a string mass. And so basically you apply what you discovered in normal quantum field theory to this, which is an example at least at low energies of a quantum field theory with a cutoff. So if you apply the same recipe, you obtain these answers for the...
It's an extension of RG flow with large infrared normalization for QCP. These are the technical conditions of QCP.
That
are not perceptible. It's not, if you write it down as a fifth thing, you would write this down. It's not obvious that you have to worry about string theory.
Hmm.
And I'm just being argumentative. So ignore it.
Okay, a comment regarding that. 2 days ago, Scott Watson and Sarah Cremonti, he showed that from string theory, you can show that phi equals one would be an attractor. They do that by starting with another dimension of sporadic theory, and they compute membrane interaction. You get near these points, you get tensionless band membranes that degrade in your back in such a way that you would be led to phi equals one, so you wouldn't roll off to infinity. I guess this would be a connection to string theory. I agree you can write down some theory without ever mentioning string theory, but you also get this effect from string theory.
So this is my basic answers, and if you look at it, you see that the conflicts in the limit of large phi tends to trivialize. So their relative dependence on phi tends to go to zero. And this reminds of the more political proposed least coupling risk. So they basically consider again an action of this type and say, well, if the effective couplings as functions of phi extremize all at some value of phi, then they show that the cosmological evolution tends to push phi toward this extremum, and because this is an extremum, so in that phi, this coupling doesn't vary on second derivatives, only at second order varies, so the equivalence principle is restored. But this, the difference is that, of course, here the minimum the extremizing point is at infinity in a sense. So while their model do not predict any observable violation of the equivalence principle, in this model you would expect an observable violation of the equivalence principle. Just a few words about the value that we may expect for the dilaton. So some of my conclusion will depend on this value, some other will not. But if you look at the cosmological evolution of the dilaton, you see that most of its evolution comes from the inflationary period, and in fact the value that it had at the end of inflation is more or less the value that it has now. So we just consider the slow roll typical potential. So chi is the inflaton, and again we assumed this pattern. So also the slow roll potential gets corrections of order into the minus pi, and quite interestingly you can relate the present value of phi to the observed best fluctuations on large scales. As you see, so since this is 10 to the minus 5, or less, 10 to the minus 5, for a value, so if I take a potential, there's no wrong potential, chi square, this is going to be e to the 5, it's going to be more or less 10 to the 5. And if you take higher order inflaton potential, you have a not so pushed far dilaton.
Thank you. One thing that for the 60 there would be the Hubble friction on the dilaton.
But the Hubble friction is exactly what makes the dilaton not change much since inflation to now. So now let's consider a bit general, revised, a bit in some generality, the relation between the presence of a coupled scalar field and violations of the equivalence principle. So the recipe is choose a conformal transform metric in such a way that you can write your Lagrangian in this way, in such a way that the scalar field does not appear multiplying the risk term. Then you will have that typically the dependence of phi will be inherited by all the other terms in case they didn't have at the beginning. And so, for instance, consider a mass term for a fermion. So the fact that a mass term depends on phi tells you that the interaction between two fermions, and if this so we are now saying let's not take care of the gravitational sector of string theory by giving phi a mass. Phi may have a mass, but it will be a very light mass of order maybe of the Hubble scale, more or less. But let's take care of the gravitational phenomenology by considering very small currents, because as we said, so in the limit where phi goes to infinity, the effective currents go to to zero. So this is the effective coupling of phi to Fermius. And when you consider the gravitational the effective gravitational interaction between two Fermius, you will have beside the three-level contribution of the graviton, the contribution of the scalar field. This contribution is weighted by the first derivative of M, since you may think of expand M and create a vertex phi and bar N. And so this vertex is precisely weighted by M prime. And the effective Newton constant between particle of different species, let's call them A and B, is gonna so you're gonna have a correction of these alpha parameters, which are not guessed at the log derivative of M. So the effective Newton constant between two given particles is phi dependent in general, and it may depend also on the composition of the particles that you are considering. And in fact, so how can we estimate the dependence of a mass of a particle of an atom, basically, on phi? Well, the main contribution is a pure QCD contribution. It's the contribution given by the pure gauge effects of QCD, and it's roughly proportional to lambda QCD. It's lambda QCD times a number over the one for variance. Then you have a QED contribution. So the fact that so this is just the contribution of the electromagnetism to the total mass of an atom because of its binding energies. And then, of course, of the same order is the contribution of the quarks, but in this case, it's much less clear the dependence of on phi. So if we calculate the alpha, the parameter, the log derivative of the mass for a generic species A, you had that the most of the contribution is hadronic, and it's just the log derivative of MQCD over phi. And then you have a correction which is proportional to the derivative of the electromagnetic coupling over phi. So I'm sorry to use alpha for two different quantities, but they are both very, very used in the literature. So this is defined as the log derivative of lambda QCD, and this is just the electromagnetic coupling. So so as I said here, so this number, so this is fixed for all elements. This number varies from one element to another, because this E here depends on the number of the weight of the mass of the element and of the atomic number in this way. So so this is the estimate of the. So so typically you may have violations of the equivalence principle in a composition independent way and in a composition dependent way. The composition independent way is for the very fact that alpha hadronic is not zero. I mean, you may have that all the elements depending in the same way. So for all the elements, this number is the same. But still, the fact that you have this component will give you composition independent effects. And or violations of the strong equivalence principle, in a sense. So in order to calculate the composition independent effects, we have to calculate the log derivative of lambda QCD. We express lambda QCD by means of the renormalization group with some V function here in terms of R effective coupling at the string minus. And what we obtain is e to the minus the value of the data from 9 times 40. 40 is more or less the log mass of the string mass over the lambda QCD itself. So so the complete would be string mass over lambda QCD times e to the minus 5.0. So these are the experimental limits on this number. The most strict have been given by Bertotti and other people just a couple of years ago. And you say that if you instead of e to the minus pi zero, you substitute the actual estimated value of the dilaton, you may already rule out. Sorry. They're both consistent with the experimental limit. So this is alpha squared. This is alpha. So in both for considering both the inflationary scenarios, you have that you shouldn't expect. Composition dependent violations of the equivalence principle. The thing is more interesting if you consider independent effect. So really you make two bodies with different composition fall in the same gravitational field and look at the different acceleration with which they fall. So this is really sensible of course to the corrections, to the electromagnetic correction, to the total mass of the spaces, of the spaces. And for instance, a typical example is I don't know how to say this in English, Q and beryllium and what's P? Cu.
Copper
and beryllium. So you make copper and beryllium fall in the same gravitational field, and you look at the difference. So this is a much smaller effect because you see that it is a second order in alpha hadronic, but it's also much better tested. So you can see that in the easiest inflationary model, we are already very close to this. To this bound, so while the n equal 4 model is ruled out. So since microscope will explore the level of 10 to the minus 15 and step, they're both satellite based experiments for this type of violations. Step will explore the 10 to the minus 18, this model may be ruled out in a definite way, in case you don't see violations even at the 10 to the minus 15. Wow. Of course, every estimate that I do is an order of magnitude estimate. So,
wouldn't you say that the rolling dilaton is ruled out, not the inflaton?
Yeah, of course.
Quick question.
Yeah. A lot depends on your solution for fire, because the equivalence principle tests. Or at some miles, the other solar system will start being useless. So, if you had a gravitational constant which is close to Newton at some miles, then you would agree with the data. I don't understand. You see, phi depends on the radius, right? From the wherever you are.
You're
assuming that phi is the same throughout the solar system.
Yeah. So in order to estimate the expected violations of this type of equivalence principle, so of the weak equivalence principle, you don't assume any variation of phi, and really the experiment that you do, at least the future satellite-based experiments, will be two bodies in a satellite that falls freely fall in the common gravitational field of the heart, and you just look at differences in their free falling. So,
if you think of a model, think of a model where the gravitational constant is close to Newton because of the solution for phi, until I get out to Sutton. And Cassini,
yeah,
I guess is for Jupiter. So, in that case, you would detect the vibration. You're making a strong assumption that phi is the same everywhere in the solar system.
Well, yeah, that's a big reminiscence of the chameleon model of Justin, I guess. So,
in your previous transparency, the composition independent,
yeah,
you're testing for the variation in phi. Well, because variation phi, that preact on the metric, which would affect both atomic interactions.
Yeah.
So I think you've already argued that.
When you look at violation of the strong equivalence principle, you exactly do what you're saying, I think, because the fact that a body is more massive than another body affects the local value of phi, and this is going to shift a little bit the value of the Newton constant. And this is how you get violations of the strong equivalence principle.
I'm worrying about the weak equivalence.
Well, the weak equivalence principle, I don't see any, because I don't see it really. Well, with Cassini, you tested the strong one, not the weak one. I mean, you test the proposition independent effects.
You actually tested Kepler's third law, the variation of chi. And when you get out to nearly beyond the semi major axis, it appears a very important thing. So, actually, using Kepler's third law is the best way to test these things. Mm-hmm. Because it's an absolute way of testing your very G, you see. So your very G from orbits all the planets. And you can determine with great accuracy what the violations are.
Yeah.
And when you get an attitude going to be old, hopefully it starts to fit. So if you have a model of phi, it's got a very good radius, right? Such a way that chi is close to Newton, you get very close to Newton, down below Jupiter, or down below Saturn, then you wouldn't have any violation. This is not a unique solution.
No, I'm interested in, this is the conventional way people address this problem. I'm curious. I would like to know more. Maybe later on. The more detailed calculation. So, just a few words before going to cosmology. Just a few words. Am I late?
No, you can go on. Mm-hmm.
Just before moving to cosmology, a few words about. Recoupling variations, because of course, whenever you have the recoupling depend upon the scalar field, you have this very related effect that you have violations of the equivalence principle, but you may also observe variations of the couplings. So, in our model, the variation of, for instance, of the electromagnetic coupling as a is a product of a cosmological source, which is just how much the field shift from, let's say, from a previous direction to now, and a fundamental piece, which is really the dependence of the electronic coupling on the field itself. So, we estimated this dependency in our model, and in general, if the dilaton has not any particular role in late time cosmology, the velocity of the field is much too small to have observable doubling variation in the last the possibility is that instead the field, I mean, if the field that plays on the other hand a central role, so for instance it is with vessels, again with a runway potential of this type, a non-capable vessel with a runway potential of this type, then interestingly enough you should expect in a Hubble time variation of the electro of the electromagnetic coupling of order 10 to the minus 6. So this is a bit less of what of the claim of a few years ago of Webb and other people. But you have this relation between the variation of the electro wind coupling and the violations of the equivalence principle. So these two numbers are related in this mode in a way which depends also on the deceleration parameter of the universe and on the present critical density of a non-relativistic matter. So this relation is not dependent on the inflationary model that you consider. This relation is really dependent only on the exponential runaway behavior of the couplings.
Just a question, vertex is the sign?
The sign?
Do you need additional information to fix the sign?
Yeah, because basically you take, so you have the F square there, you say, okay, I've got the effective electromagnetic coupling is something again as C plus the number of order 1 times e to the minus pi, and the sign has to do with the sign of this product. So this is order 1, but you are not sure about the sign of this guy. So this is how the sign came from. So now let's go to the third and final part of the seminar, where a possible application of this runaway dilaton model in cosmology, and especially in coupled quintessence model. So the relation of the previous transparency had to do only with the normal quintessence. I mean, what if the dilaton played the role of the coupled quintessence? The proposed model was why study in model tape quintessence and especially coupled quintessence? Well, the so-called coincidence problem it's rather philosophical. And it's the question why are we just in this a short period of time where the density of dark energy and the density of dark matter are of the same order, and the idea of coupled quintessence is exactly take care of the coincidence problem because if quintessence is coupled to dark matter. So of course it cannot be coupled very much to baryons because again you would have violations of the equivalence principle. But if you couple it to dark matter, which is a great sector of what you don't know much about, you can have a final configuration of the universe studied for the first time by Venturi. When you have a fixed fraction of critical density, so the dilaton has some critical density, and also a fixed acceleration. So both these parameters are given in the attractor solution by the fundamental parameter of the theory. So what you need, again, as I said, it's a coupled to dark matter of other ones. So this time one has to suppose that this idea of the trivialization of the coupling is valid for all the spaces, but some dark matter sector to which the dilaton is still strongly coupled. You also need an exponential potential, which is very natural in this framework, because all the corrections as this typical e to the minus pi behavior. And I also studied a generalization of this model. So a generalization by using kinetic high order kinetic terms in a fashion, which is a bit like the one of Gauss condensation and KSS, and we found the most general type of Lagrangian that allows a scaling behavior of this type. So this is the most general type of Lagrangian. It may be whatever function of this term. So let's go back to the simplest model, the one with the potential. So again, we consider a generic runaway dilaton action of this form. Wu again is taken to be of no perturbative origin, because we know that it's not present at the perturbative level. So it has to go like here, like an explanation. This parameter C, I mean, this is the dilaton, this is the properly normalized star field. So in going from here to here, there is this parameter C that enters the equation. And it's just related to the asymptotic values of the coupling. And again, another assumption is that there is some sector of the theory where this trivialization of the coupling is not there, but instead you have couplings of order one. So a possible evolution that you would see in this case is. So these are just the densities of the different components, and as you see, there is a final attractor solution where the density of the scalar field and the density of dark matter scale in the same way, and in this case you have an acceleration of the universe. Of course. Lately, these types of models are not very favored by the recent supernova data. This is, I think, a problem that has to do with all the attempt to solve the coincidence problem. You try to solve the coincidence problem by giving the dark energy an equation of state, which is more similar to the dark matter equation of state, so which is not minus one, but it's minus 0.8, minus 0.7. Supernova data tends to prefer the equation of state of a pure cosmological constant. So here I plotted the equation of state of this coupled dark energy over the density fraction of the quantity of the density fraction which is not coupled to the dilaton. So this is the baryonic density fraction basically. And you see that we are a bit out of the preferred region of parameter space. So although
in the latest of Y Legacy's guy survey result, they find W is equal to the minus 1.02 plus or minus 1.03. Comfortably close.
Equal to minus?
Minus 1.02 plus or minus 0.03, if I remember. It's getting uncomfortably close.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's going to be publishing as a fiscal journal.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's getting creepily close to.
When is it? Sorry, when did they publish it?
The same one the archives about a month ago.
Ah. So it's not. So, I mean, yeah, the coincidence probably is there. And we are going to probably fix it. Okay, the conclusions. Again, the idea is that the relative correction may render the three-level strong coupling region of the theory acceptable up to, I mean, acceptable with everything we know so far, but interesting composition dependent variations observable in next-to-come experiments, while there should be no testable composition independent EP relations. And a definite prediction of the model is this relation between, if the dilaton plays the role of quintessence in this model, you should have this relation between variation of the coupling and equivalence principle of variation. And also, there's this possibility of having a higher order kinetic terms that may produce the acceleration of the universe as well. And that's it.
I think I missed it. So you added this piece in the last part where you talked about the dilatoners for the essence. You had a coupling to the dark matter,
yeah,
order one, and that's to slow down the field as it's rolling down the exponential. So why did you need the coupling?
Well, if you couple the dilaton to dark matter, for instance, so, and if you write the conservation equation for their energies, for instance, is equal to minus 3h rho plus p. So this equation gives you the equation of state of the dilaton, right? So if you couple it, you have one more term here, which is typically dependent on phi dot times alpha, which is this coupling, times rho m. And you have exactly the same term in the equation for rho m. So for m, you would have rho m minus phi dot alpha rho m. So of course the energy is still conserved, but there is a transport of energy between one space to the other. And if you look now at the equation of state of this, so I'm not sure alpha is precisely here, but I mean the idea is that these two components tend to an attractor on which they both scale in a different way. Mm-hmm. So this key in the same way, which is different to their original way. And typically you may have, if the coupling is sufficiently high, you may have an acceleration because and of course this is they act as the same component, at least at the homogeneous level, and it's the component that feel like the 90% of the universe, the 95% of the universe, because that matter and dark energy field that way. So, this is the idea. Did I ask you a question?
So you say now that you change the equation of state of the dark energy?
Yeah.
Isn't it true that, well, so I thought the exponential potential you used, if you have exponential potential plus it's coupling to dark matter, is it true that I thought omega, as you said, omega phi, that the fraction of the energy density remained constant.
Yeah.
So and in particular, if
well, in other words, so I thought the puzzle with exponential potential was that if you assume that the dark energy dominates over the dark matter today, which it does, then as a function of time, it
So the exponential potential has the property of allowing scalar solutions. So it depends on the so it depends on this parameter C that you put in. So for a very low C, you just said that it behaves like a cosmological constant. So it does not allow this type of solution. But for high C, you allow this type of solution. Now, if you turn the coupling to zero, you have that it's the scalar field that behaves like the dark matter field. So they both scale as a to the minus 3. The coupling is zero. Okay. So, but if you switch on the coupling, then they still scale in the same way because this is guaranteed by this form of the potential, but with a different equation state. So, you may possibly have.
Sorry, maybe a naive question. If you this dilaton is coupled to dark matter, you just said.
Yeah.
I know that dark matter clusters. Would you expect the dilaton to cluster also?
Yeah.
Which is written out as a cosmological constant.
Well, as well. But in fact, there are some bounds on the possible capping of the dilaton, because in fact the way in which dark energy cluster, if the dilaton is coupled to it, is different. Although of course it tends to cluster much more. At least
some people look at these kind of scalar fields that you can have around how they would cluster and how they would affect.
Now I'm talking on the strictest bound that comes from the fact from the clustering of dark matter. So if dark matter is coupled to a scalar field, then again you have a contribution to this gravitational attraction. So there is some bound that you will but the bound is still over the one. I mean, it's not saying.
There's a really nice paper by Friedman and someone else.
It's a
very nice. It's a very nice paper.
They discuss many
many different ways that you could explain
While the clustering itself of the scalar field, I would say that since it's so light, it's again as for all cosmological scalars, its mass is of the Hubble size. But it may have some clustering properties, but I wouldn't expect.
Quick question. It's getting late.
Yeah.
This is a general cosmic question. There must be something like 25 models of dark energy there. Actually, I can't. Maybe they could be 40. So I don't know that. So you have in this paper. How are we going to ever decide which is correct? Because they all claim to agree with the data, by the way. Well, that's easy. You just take a super global data and you fit the parameters and you get the curve that goes through the deceleration parameter. So this is a very disturbing issue.
I completely agree with you. I completely agree with you. And in fact, I claim in general that there should be some larger parameterization of dark energy and stop speaking about specific models, but start speaking about classes of models. Say, okay, let's see dark energy that behaves more or less like that. And this is more. In order to simplify the facts. On the other hand, in this case, in this particular case, as I told you, if this is the model of dark energy, and if we are really in this region of the strong coupling of the theory, you have other tests to check it, which are related to equivalence principle violations violations of the
coupling. But you see, the supernova data is up at a redshift of about the starts are around the point of end, and the starts are around
1.7.
0.1. Point redshift at 5.1. And out there, the reason we call this physical test, you're in a whole different region from physics. You're in cosmology. What does physical test have to do with the solar system, the inner solar system? I can't use it to say anything about cosmology at all.
Well, I don't agree with your point, but...
Well, you can guess that it's true, and the redshift is 5.1.
I mean, of course, we are not going to run a Coriolis principle test at redshift z=3 because we couldn't. But I mean, we can try to model the general behavior of a scalar field and connect different observations from point to point. Right? Saying, okay, at z=1.7, it was like that. Now, I don't know. I mean, it's I don't see any. Expressions in these.
Well, there's no observation of recursion experiments at the redshift 0.1. It's only not at 1. There are no bounds on fifth force experiments beyond, I would guess, Uranus. Anyway, it's remarkable that one of the most extraordinary problems of modern physics is totally up for grabs.
I think, can't you call the agreement between numerical simulations and observations, numerical simulations of the CDM model and observations a constraint of the first experiment?
That's not best. They don't work that well. They're too cuspy.
There are some marginal things that might be problems, but I mean the
these are not marginal problems. I wouldn't call them marginal problems. Depends on who you are. As far as I'm concerned, they're not marginal problems. I think the best evidence for dark energy and dark matter is the acoustical peaks. If you try to fit them, you really get nailed down, as I've learned recently. You really know that there's the fraction of baryons is 0.4, there's something else, 30%, and then there's the rest of 70% of peaks of positions. Really tell you this.
But you could only, completely agree in a sense that. That you only get nailed down with respect to a given underlying cosmological model, which is not tested. You assume you have three models in your view, because you perturb this, and then you study the evolution of fluctuations, and then you get nailed down. But of course, there could have still the possibility that some other space types of
visual field.
There's a model which is theoretically not consistent, I would agree to that, but if there's a model by Sophia Sarkar, if you would give up the tryout age, which is very weak actually, if you really have a look to the Hubble Key Project and really check what data they really kind of disregard, throw away, and you give up the prior that age needs to be above 0.5, you give up this prior, then you can get rid of dark energy and have a better fit of the acoustic peaks.
I did a hand calculation using Bukola in the last 3 weeks over the holiday season.
Yeah.
And if you start using age the way it's 0.4, you can't fit. I fitted it with the usual results. It's not that big. If you do the hand calculation called CAP slope, it's in the book of last new book. It's really quite it's quite disturbing.
No, but he discusses this with absolute guilt and inflationary respect. He discusses this and he discusses the variation of the cosmological parameters with respect to a given inflationary model. But if you model also, because there's a